Good evening. James McCanny here with My Science Hours. This is June 11, 2015. Many topics to cover tonight. I'll be talking about Pluto. I'll be talking about the G7 meeting that just finished, where they're talking about eliminating fossil fuels by the end of the century. But, gee, that sounds pretty good, except it's only 2015. That's 85 years away. How absurd. And so a little bit about Pluto starting out. This past week, very interesting the way this was released. NASA, apparently for a long time, had this information about Pluto's moons. Now, originally, a number of years ago, they discovered that Pluto had a moon called Charon, and it's really almost like a double planet. It's half the size of Pluto. So we always think of, for example, Earth going around the Sun, and the Sun is stable and it doesn't move. Well, really, the Sun does move. The Sun interacts with all particles, even the finest grain of dust, even though you'd be hard-pressed to notice that. But the Sun, in fact, does move and responds to the motion of Jupiter and Earth and Saturn and all the other planets. And so it kind of moves around in the area where it's at. But in a case like Pluto, Pluto's moon is commensurate in size. Therefore, they, in a sense, orbit each other. It's like a twin planet. And this is something that's very interesting. However, there are some other features that seems to be coming out of the woodwork here. Three of the moons of Pluto seem to be in fairly stable orbits. However, the other two moons are in erratic orbits and are tumbling. Now, tumbling, you might think, like if you throw a wrench, you might think that's tumbling. But these are swinging back and forth and moving kind of like they're dangling on a string almost. Very strange motion. When things are free-floating in outer space, and I'll explain that in just a second, the objects, if they're tumbling, they tend to rotate in that direction. And this is basically a principle of physics. But to have them moving back and forth, kind of like they're dangling on a string, is extremely unusual. And NASA's like, oh, ho-hum, yeah, that's pretty normal. Except, ho-hum, it's not very normal. So what exactly is causing these objects to swing around back and forth willy-nilly, so to speak, at this point anyway? But the interesting part is they have had this data for a long time. Well, why are they releasing it now? Well, because the New Horizon space probe is about to arrive at Pluto this July. I mean, this is June. I mean, this is a month away. And interestingly enough, they have not released any more pictures from the New Horizon spacecraft for over a week. Obviously, they're getting better and better pictures, and they're sitting on those pictures. Obviously, Pluto is turning up some surprises. I wonder if Pluto has a comet tail. That would be a surprise. But see, these are all things that could be photoshopped out of the photos before they're presented to you, the public. Remember that when sighting spring went by Mars gained a considerable atmosphere. When Comet Lovejoy passed by Mars, we noticed, it was observed, many people saw this, that Mars actually grew a coma. So, on occasions in the past, we've seen Venus grow a tail in the SOHO cameras, very visible. And so planets do develop tails, something that Earth does quite regularly. And they're just starting to make the measurements, something that has eluded scientists. A young Australian physicist, young lady, has discovered exactly what I've been predicting all along, is the upper atmosphere has plasma tubes attached to it. I have drawings of these in my books, etc. And so anyway, let's go back out to Pluto. Now, Pluto is in an area called the Kuiper region. That's where many, many, many planets have been discovered. And yes, they are planets. They're round. They have characteristics. But they're starting to see details on planet Pluto. And as of about 8 days ago, NASA stopped releasing photos. So obviously they're seeing something, and they're seeing something that doesn't match with standard their standard story. So I'm predicting that as we get close to Pluto, there's going to be a lot of photoshopping going on in NASA. Probably a few Disney animators in there to give us some nice animated pictures of what Pluto's supposed to look like. But I'm just wondering how much of this data is going to be scuttled, and we'll really never see the total picture. But apparently Pluto has an atmosphere. We already know that. It does have methane. It has some other gas elements, but it's too early to really tell. I'll just wait until New Horizon gets there next month. I believe it's the 14th of July is the actual flyby date. I remember back, it was 2005, July 4th, when the comet Tempel 1 deep impact mission was supposed to crash into the comet nucleus, and I was on the Coast to Coast AM radio show. I was the guest, and we were waiting, as promised by NASA, they were going to release the data that night to the world, and boom, lockdown. They didn't release any data for 6 months. It was very sparse data, and I remember George Norrie and I are sitting there waiting for the data to be released, and we're going, what's going on? And we knew enough at that point that no water came out of the impact hole because they thought that they were going to strike pay dirt, in other words, water. And so all of the data got fudged and hocus-pocused. But the end result was on that July 4th date, which was been announced and pre-announced for years beforehand, no data. So I'm wondering if we're in for the same scenario with the New Horizons spacecraft passing Pluto. But I suspect we're going to have some real fudging going on with this data, because Pluto's an anomaly, and this is why. If you are out where Pluto is and you look back at the sun would look like kind of a bigger than average star. It wouldn't flicker. It would be noticeably bigger than your average star. Or if you looked at, for example, Sirius in the star, which is the biggest star in the sky, the brightest star, or some of the other ones that are in the southern hemisphere, the closest star, the Alpha Centauri complex of stars, which are the closest stars to Earth, fairly bright, the sun would not look much bigger than those or brighter from the distance of Pluto. And so, you know, you get about as much light energy there as a foggy night in London with a weak burned-out flashlight. Let's just put it that way. Not a lot of light entering the region of Pluto. So you're not going to expect, I mean, if this Pluto guy were 4.5 billion years old, like they're saying it should be, according to standard theory, then it should be a cold, cold, very cold, dry rock. Any gases, I don't care if it's methane, I don't care if it's carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, it would be frozen, crystallized out of the atmosphere and fall into the ground long, long ago, and it wouldn't have any atmosphere at all, let alone weather. Weather? You know, this is, you know, my weather book talks about this, that without the electrical conditions and the plasma conditions around Earth, we wouldn't have any weather. And so, you know, but the standard story for weather at Earth is that the sunlight comes in, heats up the atmosphere, causes the jet streams, causes tornadoes and hurricanes, and in the warming of seawater, so hurricanes form and all this. But it's when you do the energy equation, it's absolutely ludicrous, because Earth weather would be simply non-existent. if it were simply dependent on solar light energy. Most of the light from the sun is blocked in our upper atmosphere. The visible light comes through. The infrared is blocked. The microwaves are blocked. The upper, the higher end, the ultraviolet, most of it is blocked. We do get a dose of that. If the X-rays are blocked, and a lot of the higher energy gamma rays and et cetera are blocked in the upper atmosphere. If it weren't for that, we'd all be dead, because the sun is putting out some serious strong energy in those other parts of the spectrum. And so the little bit of light is the visible, what we call visible light, the part that our eyes see. And in fact, that's why our eyes are adjusted to the visible light spectrum, because that's the light that's available. Why would we evolve with eyes that see X-rays like Superman if there's no X-rays to be found? And why would our eyes, like fish and dogs and cats who hang out at night, or fish who are in the water who have to see in darkness, basically their eyes have evolved to see in the infrared. And we need special equipment to see in the infrared. It's infrared night vision equipment. But our eyes are tuned to like daytime visible light spectrum. So that's all that comes into the planet Earth. And so what they're seeing now, they're getting closer, and they're starting to see structure on planet Pluto. Now, I suspect what's going on is that they're seeing weather patterns. They're talking about possibly a North Polar Cap. And so if there's weather, if they're going to, let's say they see some hurricane-type activity on Pluto. Well, how is that caused by the sun? Now, this is what I mean. Pluto is a very strange case. It's way, way beyond, way out there. And so there's no solar light input to cause weather, to cause it to have a viable atmosphere. And Pluto is small. Pluto is not a big planet, so its surface gravity is very low compared to even Earth or our moon. So what's the story here? Weather on Pluto? But this is what I'm just going to make a statement, because I'm already smelling this. I won't make any comparisons, but the Pluto's surface features are telling me that I'm predicting that Pluto will blow the theoretical cap off of NASA and Tier 2 science. And they're already seeing this. I'm suspecting they probably are seeing a comet tail associated with Pluto and possibly the other five moons. And as these swing around Pluto, and as Pluto swings around Charon, the moon, the larger moon, then the comet tails could be visible from a distance. Now, if NASA is seeing comet tails around Pluto, all of a sudden that complicates their story, because remember, comets are only supposed to be viable near the sun. They call it the Goldilocks zone, or the Christmas zone, or the Santa Claus zone. There's various names. Because within that region, that's when the snow is supposed to come off the comets. And by the way, I just wanted to iterate this too, that Rosetta mission this past week, I put a posting about this on my webpage, and this announcement actually came out quite a while ago, but they're just kind of publicizing it now. They released 1,700 new photos of Comet 67P with the Rosetta spacecraft mission. 1,700 new photos, which give us an incredibly detailed look at the surface of this comet nucleus. And essentially, when you approach this comet or any of the other comets that we've approached with spacecraft in the past, you see it as a bright white nucleus from a distance. And you see the comet tail there. You can take a look at the elements in the comet tail. There's, of course, typically water. Then you have the carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, ammonias, the nitrogen, hydrogen compounds, the carbon hydrogen compounds, carbon oxygen compounds, etc., and hydrogen oxygen, etc. You'd have deuterium. In fact, they have discovered DNA. The basic nucleotides of DNA have been discovered, and they're just chemical, very simple chemical constructs, which are the basis of DNA. So, in a sense, the basis of life. But they form in the comet tail. But once you get closer to the comet nucleus, you penetrate through that cloud of brilliant white gases and dust that's surrounding the comet nucleus, and you get through that, the last few kilometers, you see a black nucleus with nothing coming off of it. You get down close, and you can't see any water or carbon dioxide. Now, supposedly, all this gas is coming off the nucleus. So shouldn't it be most abundant and most concentrated at the nucleus where supposedly it's coming from? With their spectrometers, they cannot find a trace of water, of carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, or anything else. Now, I had direct communication with the Rosetta mission team leaders, and I said, where did you measure? Because they came out and they said, we've seen carbon dioxide and water and all of this at the comet nucleus. And I said, where did you actually measure it, boys and girls? And they admitted it was at 10 and 100 kilometers from the nucleus. They did not measure a drop, a molecule, an atom near the comet nucleus. Yet they see jetting type activity in their pictures, which are very much tone adjusted out of this world, just to see them. But all that is dust jetting activity due to the electrical conditions around the nucleus. Levitating dust is something that's very common, and that's what they're seeing. They're seeing this levitating dust activity around the comet nucleus, but nothing of gas and dust. But they keep saying, the gas and the dust is being blown away, blown off the surface of the nucleus by jetting action of carbon dioxide, water, volatiles that are sublimating off the comet nucleus. But they said, and this is the point I was getting at, they said at the Rosetta mission, they said the comet nucleus is too hot to have any water ice on the surface. So if it's too hot to have water ice, it's really too hot to have carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, etc., which are dry ice. The dry ice is a form of ice. It freezes at a much lower temperature than water, but of course it's much more volatile. At a higher temperature, it's going to boil away. And so basically, by saying there is no water on the surface, they're saying there ain't nothing else either, boys and girls, grandmas and grandpas. And so then they're going, we think. Now, that's the think. Now, they should put think in about 80-point lettering and say think. They think there's some in underneath the surface. But when you look at the pictures that have come out of Rosetta, and I didn't post them on my page yet because I don't want to subtract people from my fundraising effort, which is I'll speak about in a few minutes here. That's mainly what I want to concentrate on. I don't want to divert the public's attention to something else, the silly science of NASA. But I'll spend a few minutes on this radio show. When you look at the photos, the 1,700 newly released photos of the nucleus of Comet 67P with the Rosetta spacecraft right there, rotating around, orbiting this nucleus, taking very close-up detailed photos, you can clearly see, for example, striated rock structures, which were the result of this piece of rock being built up inside of a planet over the period of time. Now, this is striated rock. This is layered rock that's built up, for example, from dust accumulation and impacting, and then variations in that, and that gives it the layered look, just like we see on Earth, from either water buildup or rain, or it could be due to oceans or dust settlement on rock, etc. But anyway, these layers built up, and you can see that this piece of rock has been blasted out of something bigger. This is a chunk of some bigger planet. in the past, and there's no, absolutely no question about that at all. And so where is the dirty snowball that supposedly coalesced billions of years ago? And certainly there's no ice or carbon monoxide or carbon dioxide ice down deeper in this object. It's a very solid layered rock, and it's got some dust and pulverized material on the surface. And then it's got some cratering. It's got some cratering, and for example, the moon Hyperion of Saturn is very deeply cratered also, and these are due to the electron beams. The electron beams in the comet phase burning out those craters, and you know, the dust remaining back on the surface. In the Hyperion case, the craters are filled with hydrocarbons that are burned in place, so they're very black, dark inside those burned craters. All of this makes perfect sense, but back to Pluto. It's out there in the Kuiper region where I've said before that's a very rich area for material, for comet tails, and so these planets are forming out there. And the very possibility that these could be tossed in into the inner solar system at any given time, and there should be some big planets out there. Thus the announcement of astronomers a number of months ago, it was back in October, two astronomers, actually a team of astronomers, said that they had been looking for Planet X objects, and they had discovered the perturbations of many of these smaller objects out there in the Kuiper region, and they said this could only be due to two large Planet X type objects out in that region, although they had not seen them yet. Because you have to understand that even though they might be big, you have to look right at them. These would be moving along with a star pattern in the background. They're very difficult to discover, even though they have automated search equipment, etc. But once again, back to Pluto, I am expecting Pluto has already, and that's why they've shut down releasing any photos, that Pluto has already thoroughly disproven any of the standard Tier 2 fairy tale science on how the solar system formed, supposedly, allegedly, 4.5 billion years ago. And Pluto just does not fit into the picture. So they're scrambling, trying to figure out, and clearly Jim McCanney has been right on top of this again. Sorry about that, but as I talked for a long time about the fact that the Kuiper objects are out in this region of very high concentration of dust, gases, molecular atomic species, etc., that can combine, and then also discharging the solar capacitor out there, I suspect they're seeing comet tails around these objects, and that's what the fuss is all about. Okay, well, more on that, and I'm very excited about this. I hope NASA doesn't scuttle this data, but I'm already seeing it happen. So I guess fasten your seatbelts. Pluto, a very interesting object, and the moons, etc. The G7 meeting occurred this past week with Merkel, of Chancellor of Germany, standing next to little Obama, middle management, both of them middle management of the World Bank, and they are calling for three things. One is to end the use of carbon-based fuels by the end of the century. Number two is to ward off hunger, to cure the world hunger problem. And this, their solution is to give loans from the World Bank. In other words, first they cause hunger and starvation in these countries. Then they come in and they want these countries where starvation is occurring to get loans. Gee, what's that going to do? Put money into the pocket of Monsanto, who's going to dump their GMO food into these third world countries for the poor people to eat there. But the third thing was immunization. They want a needle in everybody. And they're using Ebola, which they created. The Ebola crisis is man-made, under the guise of this same group of people. And, of course, these are the so-called elected leaders. They're really appointed leaders. Little Obama couldn't get elected out of a paper bag. But, of course, he's president, appointed And I suspect my prediction is that Hillary Clinton will be the next president, as much as I hate to even imagine that. But Hillary has really sold her soul to the devil. She will do anything, and in the past has done anything. But the reason she lost the bid for the election last time is she got a little bit too big for her britches, and she thought that Hillary was going to be powerful. And what she then was had to be kind of put in her place to understand that, no, Hillary is working for the man, in other words, the Rothschilds, in the Rockefellers in New York, etc. So she became the senator from New York for a while, then Secretary of State, so now she's put in her dues. But this is the last shot for Hillary, let's face it. And so little Jeb down there in Florida, the other, what would you call him, royalty family of the United States, the Bushes, he's going to just have to wait, but that's fine. They'll dump him off in the next election and put him in as president. But, yeah, Hillary, I'm sure, is a shoe-in because she will do what they want. If it comes down to killing all the grandmas in a town, Hillary's there. She'd be the one to boot stomp on them and then make sure they're all dead, kicking the last one right in the teeth. And so, you know, that's my prediction. But back to the G7, I thought I saw Billy in the group, Billy Clinton. He had his face down and kind of hiding it when the picture was taken. I might be mistaken. But at any rate, they want to get rid of carbon-based fuel by the end of the century. And I read that and I'm going, wait a minute, you know, end of the century, this is 2015, that's 85 years away, you know, by the math that I grew up with. So none of these people would even be alive, nor their grandchildren, probably by that point. So, you know, how can politicians make statements like this and sleep at night? What an absolutely absurd thing to say, that they would get rid of carbon-based fuels. But see, what they're trying to do is push the world into nuclear power, which brings up my next topic. The government in the United States right now has incentives. They will pay you to put solar on your house. This is being pushed by independent third party independent companies. And the whole reason for doing this is to take that investment money out of the hands of the public, putting it into something that won't work. And then at some point, the power company is going to call up and they're going to say, you can't use your solar panels because if you do, we can't control the voltage. And so they're making these promises like, save up to 80% of your energy bill. But it's not 100%, you see. That's the catch. And that's at today's prices. And so if you can save up to 80% of your bill, well, you're just not going to get that last 20% out, and that's where the power company comes in. You are hook, line, and sinker caught on them. So at any rate, once again, it comes back to the fact that my wing generator is the only solution on the planet that will replace, I'm talking about replace the central power companies. I'll be talking about that in just a few minutes. But let me just jump up to Canada here. This past week, a listener wrote in, he says, hey, you know, your wing generator project should go great up here in Canada. A lot of open spaces up here. And so he sent me a link to a group called CANWEA, C-A-N-W-E-A, C-A-N-W-E-A, CANWEA. And so it stands for Canadian Wind Electric Association, and it sounds pretty darn good on the surface, but when you look at who the members are on the Board of Trustees, it's General Electric, Siemens, Pattern, and some of the companies that are the big installers, they're also represented on the board by the big power companies, the big government-sanctioned power companies of Canada. And so what have you got? You've got a conglomeration of good old boy network companies, government agencies, etc. There's a new movie that has just come out. It's a documentary. It's called Downwind. Downwind. And I suggested you go watch it because you're going to learn what I have been talking about all along, and it's coming to roost in Canada. So you go to Canwea, and what do they have? They have a subpage where you can go see their installed base. They have so many thousands and thousands of wind turbines, supposedly providing electricity for tens of 68,000 homes here and so many tens of thousand homes there. And the end result, however, is that when people study these, and there's many YouTube videos that are starting to come out showing that the wind generation from these towers, these three-blade wind generator towers, and we've all seen those, they're in every picture for green energy that you can find, and through the trade magazines and green web pages and Greenpeace, and everybody's putting up three-blade wind generators, they don't work. They do not work. They don't work at high wind speeds. They don't work at medium to low wind speeds. They really don't work at all. In fact, the central power companies don't even want them turned on. So if you go out and look at these, I was just at a big installation last summer out in California, and none of the blades were turning, and I went up to a little local store there down the road from one of the wind generators, and I said, you know, does that, and that when I was there, the wind generator was not turning. Obviously was brand new, very shiny and everything, and they said, no, this wind generator does not ever turn. It's always turned off. It's tethered because the wind is too strong there, so literally it never produces any energy at all. And so that's the story. These people are getting government subsidies to the tune of about $500,000 a year for something that produces no energy at all. Now, the people are paying for this, but this is starting to come to roost. And so this documentary, Downwind, I believe it's on YouTube now. You can go see that. But this is what I've been talking about. This is what I talk about in my wing, the McCanny Wing Generator World Energy Project. That's what I talk about. There's a chapter in there. It's called The Myth of Alternative Energy. I was looking in my notes, going through some of my files, and it was in about it was February 16, 2011. I was a guest on Coast to Coast AM radio show, and the topic was The Myth of Alternative Energy, where I discussed a number of these issues. But at any rate, this is such a dichotomy in the world. The lie of the three-blade wind generator, that it's somehow green, and I hate to say it, but greenies and tree huggers, which I love them all, but they are very easily fooled. And they the whole purpose of the three-blade wind generator, if you see who sells them, who builds them, General Electric, Siemens, the companies that have vested interest in nuclear and coal-generated and power plants, primarily nuclear, etc., and that's what they're trying to force the United States into nuclear. This is what Obama's shutting down coal plants, which are actually have cleaned up their act. They're actually very clean burning. But we shouldn't be burning any of these. We should not have ever burned any of these. And so, at any rate, I'm just going to mention something about Tesla here. There's probably nobody that's done more real groundbreaking theoretical work regarding the topic of Nikola Tesla than myself, because what I've discovered is the energy source that he was looking for and found for, and that was the energy source of the vertical electric field of Earth. And remember, Tesla did not understand solar wind. He did not understand the conditions outside the planet. But he knew how to tap into that. And so anyway, I talk about that in my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. But the reason I'm mentioning this now is because on my webpage, and for a long time, I had a picture, I still have it there, the picture of Wardenclyffe, the big Tesla tower out on Long Island, New York. And the whole point of this tower was to collect energy. Now, this has been turned, and I just can't stand it when I see people jumping up and down in their Tesla this and Tesla that, and they talk about him transmitting energy with this. Well, boys and girls, where was Tesla going to get the energy to transmit? Did this just appear out of thin air? No. He had sold his technology to the Westinghouse sale, etc., and the, you know, the Morgan and the boys were all investing in the future to make sure that in the 20th century, you all were enslaved to high energy content fuels. When they discovered that Tesla was extracting energy from the atmosphere for free, they went down out and tore down his tower. They sent the goons out. And this story has been twisted and convoluted into the something about Tesla transmitting power. And, of course, a Tesla tower can do that. But it's not a very good idea. You kill birds, you kill lots of stuff on the way. And so, at any rate, the question is, why did I not continue with the building of a Tesla tower to solve world energy problems? I've been working on this for a very long time. Well, the reason is very simple. The Tesla energy, or the Tesla tower, is very difficult to control. Once you tap into the capacitor that's up in the ionosphere and that starts draining down a hole in the atmosphere, that's what you're doing. You're drilling electrically through the dielectric of the atmosphere. You're drilling a hole, and once that capacitor starts to unload, that capacitor is going to unload completely. And so you have this vast amount of energy to deal with, and there are ways to deal with that. But then you have, if you have a passing solar storm, you have problems, you have surges. You know, it's just really, really a difficult technology to control. And so it'd be like having big, big vats of gasoline and lighting them on fire and trying to control them out in the open air. That's about what it would be like. Very difficult technology to control. Additionally, when you're doing your testing, you have to have a load. In other words, the term load means, what are you going to power with that Tesla tower? So you basically, you need a couple cities to hook your Tesla tower to dump the power into. And so this is all a big technical problem. The cabling, the wiring of this, the control of the surge that's coming from the ionosphere down to the Tesla tower, etc. It's just really a difficult technology to manage. So I went out and I said, no, wind is the answer. But the solutions, the so-called solutions that are on the market today, the three-blade wind generator and then also solar panels, are partial solutions. They're not the solution. They're not the thing that's going to get us off of the three big heat energy sources, coal, nuclear, and oil. So at any rate, many, many years ago, I started this project, and that the wing generator is the ultimate design that I've come up with. But I'm just going to take a sidetrack here with about 20 minutes to go in the show and tell everybody out there, I have my my crowdfunding effort that's going now. It's on a website called Indiegogo, but the link is at the top of my homepage. Now, I know that there's a big audience listening to this show tonight, and by tomorrow morning, I would like all of you, right now while you're listening to this show, if you got your computer handy, log on to my webpage, jmccsci.com, right at the very top. There's a link there. Click on that, and you'll go to my crowdfunding webpage. It's and that's not my webpage. That's another one. And I'm doing this because it's a very official way to do crowdfunding, fundraising. And the write-up is there. You can read the short write-up. And then click on Contribute Now, or there's many perks. A perk is something that you get when you contribute. So if you contribute $50, you get a printable poster and screensaver. If you give $100, you get the same two, the screensaver and the printable poster, and you get my book, McCanny Wing Generator, World Energy Project, along with it. There are licensing fees if people want to develop, developer licensing fees that go anywhere from $500 up to, well, big prices for big companies. Also, you could buy a wing generator, $30,000, and by next April, we'll be delivering it to your ranch or homestead or site, etc. Now, the crowdfunding is for the what I call the 12-meter size. This is 12 meters in diameter, and it's a far cry from the big generators. What I want to do is bring a product to market, and that's why the crowdfunding effort. I'm looking for $50,000, and right now it's a two-month fundraising effort, and I'm on target. Right now I'm on target, but what I want, now the minimum contribution is $5. And so if you cannot afford any more than $5, I'm going to tell you why that $5 is important, because every little bit counts, of course. But that's a vote. That's a vote saying that you favor what I'm doing, that you trust what I'm doing. And when other people that don't listen to this radio show, that don't know much about me, go to that fundraising site, they're going to go, "Dagon, this guy's got a lot of people who are, they're putting in $5, but those are people who can't afford much." And there's going to be a lot of these new people that come to that website, and they're going to look at your donation, the number of donations. You can donate anonymously, or you can put your name in there, but $5. And I know a lot of people out there, a lot of my audience, they're not the richest people in the world. A lot of them are hurting. But I'd like you to go to that webpage and donate $5, $10 if you can, $50 if you can. There are people donating $500 anonymously in the program. And so, you know, it's all over the board. It's what people can afford and what they feel comfortable with, and also their value of what I'm doing. Ultimately, my goal is to replace coal, nuclear for electricity, and oil, to replace oil and hydrocarbons as the basis of energy for transportation. In other words, I want electric cars and motorcycles, especially in the third world. Now, the 12-meter model is the one I'm building. And remember, I've been through the whole Tesla thing, the Tesla Tower, the Tesla Energy, tremendous source of energy, but there's some problems with it, technical problems. It's going to be a very difficult technology, especially in third world countries, to manage. They don't have a lot of necessity for electricity right now. You find a lot of these countries have, you know, much fewer appliances. They might have a refrigerator and a couple of electric lights that they burn at night. And so they don't have a big requirement like, say, in the United States. So the 12-meter model is meant for some of these remote communities to get them off the grid. Because, and somebody asked me, they said, "Well, aren't you going to have trouble getting the grid to accept your energy and bring it into the grid and deliver it to the people?" I'm not going to connect this to the grid. I'm not going to talk to the local power company or ask their permission. What we're going to do is put these in and then cut the cord to the power, the centralized power company. These communities will go independent. That's the entire point. And when you start seeing on the internet these communities running their entire community on wing power and say they need a little extra boost, some of the people there have an auto repair shop, they have a woodworking shop, a metalworking shop where they're doing welding, they're going to need more electricity. Well, we'll put in another one or two of these 12-meter wing generators, and all of a sudden, they're going to be running their little industries on pure wind power, but with my wing generators. Now, if you can see where this is going, I estimate that there are currently 100,000, this is worldwide, 100,000 potential customers for what I am doing here, the 12-meter model, 12 meters in diameter, wing generator. And if, like I say, go to the top of my webpage, jmccsci.com, and click on that link and go there. There's a picture of the wing generator and a little bit of a write-up. But please donate $5 if that's all you can do. I'd rather have 1,000 people donate $5 than 5 people donate $1,000, if you understand what I mean. That really tells me something. And like I say, when other people go to that website and look at it, they're not going to know me like you know me. And so they're going to look, how many people have donated to this? And they're going to see people like $5, $10, and they're going to go, you know, these people don't have money, but they're trying. They're trying to contribute something. That's telling them something. And then some of those people are going to have money, and there's going to be people coming in that are going to drop $1,000 or $2,000 or $5,000 in there because you gave $5. Do you understand what I'm saying? This is very important. This is extremely important. And the end goal is to develop the marketable. This is ready for market. In other words, a turnkey, come to an installation, cement pad, boom, there's a wing generator, hook it up to their electrical system, and these people are electrically independent. They cut the cord to the central power company, and you know what's going to happen? Well, yeah, I'm going to get some feedback. I already have, but I don't care because I have released my information in my book last September. I released the book, McCanny Wing Generator World Energy Project, with all this information in it. And so it's not like I'm going to a venture capital group who would take this information, move it off into the energy industry, and it would be buried so deep that it would never see the light of day. So I hope you understand what I'm doing here. I'm taking this technology directly to the public. And so that's one of the beauties of crowdfunding. It's a way for you to say, I'm breaking away too. And so in the United States, let me just follow this up. Eventually in the United States, we're going to have many pocket communities that will be going on wing power. And I call it wing, not wind. I want to differentiate my design from the old wind technologies, which are a disaster. So I call it wing generator. And that's literally what it is, a very efficient way to extract energy from the wind. And so then the other part of it is there's a storage component that could be either batteries or compressed air or other forms of energy storage. And that's another part of the equation that we're working on in the background, so that when we come in, we have a turnkey system. You set it up on a big ranch. And I know there are people on the Scriptures for America network that are out there, ranchers. I want you also to go out, click on my webpage if you're not savvy about internet type of things. Get a friend, get your kids, one of your nieces, nephews, or somebody to help you on the internet. Go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. Click on that link at the top of the page, and it'll take you to the website. Put in a donation, $5, $10, $50, $100. And someday in the near future, hopefully this year or within the next, let's say, 12 months, these installations will start to go into the United States, and entire ranches will become wing-independent community that is going to carry into the future. And it'll be in the United States primarily, though, to begin with. I'll be installing these 12-meter models outside of the United States, and there's a reason for that, because we don't have the coding. We don't have the big corporations that have their mitts in everybody's business, in their hands in the back pockets of every legislator out there. And so I have to maneuver through this labyrinth of politics and companies, established companies, and vested interest in old technology that doesn't work so that they can preserve the central power company. I have to, and then all of the new so-called alternative energy solutions, which are not solutions, they're going to guarantee that the central power company stays there. Solar is not a solution. Sure, they'll sell you solar panels. They'll sell you $200,000 worth of solar panel, but you still got to connect to the grid. And, hey, you're not going to be able to sell your power back to the grid. And there's going to be a day that comes soon, it's already here in many places, where they're going to call up and say, you can't use your solar panels. You cannot connect those into the grid because they cannot control the voltage. It's as simple as that. So, yeah, the ranchers out there, get please dig into your pocketbook a little bit and put in a donation. This is a world energy solution. This is something that has not happened before. This is brand new. The technology is there. And what is so special about this technology? Well, what's so special is, first of all, it's very efficient. It's very efficient at extracting the energy from the wind. Number two, it's scalable. Now, what does scalable mean? Let me give you a couple examples. Say you were going to put in a solar panel installation on your roof. Okay, you have enough area on your roof and for a certain amount of energy to be developed by those solar panels. Very, very few people on this planet have enough roof space to provide enough solar panel area to provide all your energy needs. And so you can't expand it. You could put a field of solar panels out in front of your house, but still, it's not going to be enough to power all of your energy needs because the sun doesn't shine all the time. You're going to have two or three cloudy days and you're not going to have any energy at all. So you're going to have to go back to that power company. Ultimately, solar is a band-aid. It doesn't work. It's not going to provide you with 100% of your energy needs. Let's look at wind. That the wind turbines that have been developed, the three-blade wind turbines that you see strewn all over the countryside, they don't work. They don't work at high wind speeds. They don't work at mid and low wind speeds. They don't extract much energy. The power company will tell you all day long what their installed base is of energy, but what they're quoting is the maximum energy if all of those towers were running and there was a 35-mile-an-hour wind blowing and all of them were turned on and running. The reality is that you would be lucky to get 10% of the energy that they're talking about. So they simply don't work, and they've conned a lot of people into putting these in their backyards, out on the farm, etc. They're noisy. They're making people sick. When I designed my wing generator, I looked at all of these negative factors and I said, we got to get rid of these. We can't have a wind energy generation system that has all of these flaws. It makes people sick. They're noisy. They kill birds and bats. We've got to do away with all of that. So all of this has been cured in my wing energy design for extracting energy from the wind, and also scalable. Now, the other systems, the three-blade wind generator, you can get up to maybe a meg and a half, 1.5 megawatts. The bigger ones they're installing today, Siemens just came online with a 2.3-megawatt system. That, they think, is big. My systems can replace 300 to 400 of those wind generation towers with one of mine. That's called scalable. That means you can make them bigger and bigger and bigger. And the reason is because they spin slowly. There's a myth that I discovered in my engineering studies that there's a myth that's been propagated that the wind generators have to spin fast to extract energy from the wind. And what I discovered is no, just the opposite is true. They have to spin, but they don't spin very fast. And that's the most efficient way to extract energy from the wind. And I could give maybe a number of month college, university level engineering lecture on this very topic. But the end result is that these are scalable. So they can be built, and I already have the engineering studies done, to build these up to 1,000 feet tall. This is a 1,000-foot diameter. That's a fifth of a mile in diameter energy wheel that's extracting energy from the wind very efficiently. These are capable of replacing two nuclear power plants. One of these wing towers will replace two nuclear power plants in the future. And so you start to see where I'm going with this. We are going to replace. We're not going to go up and ask. We're not going to be nice about this. We're not going to go up to the central power company that's burning coal and nuclear. And the other thing we can do is produce enough excess energy so that you will be able to get an electric car and drive it. Now, that's one of the other big problems with current electric. The power companies, the electric companies, simply cannot produce enough electricity to power automobiles and motorcycles and trucks and buses and replace carbon-based fuels for transportation. So that's the thing. The other thing that my wing design will do is replace carbon-based fuel for automobiles. We'll be running on either high-pressure tank automobiles and trucks and cars. They are already doing it in Europe. And also the motor scooters in third world countries, that's a major mode of transportation, will be running strictly on wing power, and we'll get rid of coal, nuclear, and big oil in the next 10 years. That's my plan. But I need your help, so please go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. That's seven letters. I'll give it again in a minute. And click on the link at the top. That'll take you to the crowdfunding page. And over on the right-hand side, it says Contribute Now. Click on that, or down on the right-hand side, it says Perks. You'll get something if you donate $50, $100 or more. There is also a developer's page. If you want to be an individual who wants to build one of these for yourself, or if you're a company that wants to develop these and build your own design based on my technology, you can buy the rights to do that, all on this crowdfunding web page. All the information is there. But for the average person out there, please go there, donate $5, $10, whatever you think is you can do, $100 if you can, $500 if you really believe in this. And that's going to send a message. But I want people to understand, don't think it's too little to give $5, because what that's going to do is going to send a message, like I say, to those other people coming to this website that, hey, there's a lot of people that are interested in this. These are people, they're not rich people, but there's a reason why they're putting their $5 or their $10 into this project. And like I say, that'll generate more revenue just because of the fact that you gave your $5. So that's what I'm asking for. Once again, the website, JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo, seven letters, JMCCSCI.com. At the very top, click on the link. Go to the crowdfunding webpage over on the right-hand side that says Contribute Now. Click on that, and it'll take you to a page where you can decide how much you want to donate, and then or click on a perk, and you'll get something. I'm out of time. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.